Have you started yet? Sorry.
Yes. Direct from the Los Angeles Underground, it's time for your new favorite podcast, The Superiority Complex. It's like honey in your ear holes. It's good to do that again. Usually we have Justine, but
that's right.
Today it's just me and John. Hello, John Sandy.
Hello, Mario.
How weird is it that we record around the corner from a place that builds pipe organs?
Oh, is that still there?
It's open. It's a pipe organ factory. God. I drove by today. It's wide open. There's people in there working.
I remember that place, but God, it's still there. Wow. I guess I was getting mixed up with the Daily News, which isn't there anymore. You know, it's now a storage space.
Yeah, there's a pipe organ. How long has that organ builder's been there?
Since I think I moved to Whittier in 68,
Build organs. Is there that big of a demand? Is it like
I was going to say
Tex and Edna Boyle's Organ Emporium from SCTV?
Yeah, I'm wondering, is that like home Wurlitzer organs or is that for like theaters?
Yeah.
Duh, theaters.
Or like churches maybe?
Yeah, that's what it would be. Theaters. Theaters haven't needed an organ since 1927, yeah. Christ, where's my brain? And then they go to the talkies.
It
would be like churches, I guess.
Maybe you play Red River Valley on that thing.
Like,
come and sit by my side if you love me.
Yeah, that was probably like 30, 40 years ago. There's probably more of a market for selling those to homeowners.
Do you remember they would have the organ guy in the mall? Do you remember that?
Yes.
Like the mall, walk by and somebody would be playing something on the organ?
Yeah. And he was selling them, right?
Yeah.
Robert Klein did a routine about that. I was telling you about that. He did a routine, like back in the 60s, they'd have it on TV. They'd have commercials, so like, hey, buy a Wurlitzer organ. And they go, hey, come on in, folks. After dinner, the dad would play something and it would inevitably be Red River Valley. Come on in, Tad, Susie, I'll play a number. How about Red River Valley, Dad? Sure. It looked like it was the only number he knew. You know?
Did you know anybody who had an organ?
No. No, I don't think so. Because you'd either have to be pretty wealthy or you'd have to be somebody that it was like a...
If you're going to have a home organ, it's got to be a Hammond B3 so you get that funky sound.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
What was the one that Ray Charles played?
It was a Hammond B3.
Yeah. I remember somebody, he laughed. He said, nobody thought that was a cool organ until like what I say.
Yeah.
Somebody said, gee, that thing, it looks like it barely could stand up. And then after that, everybody's like, hey, where do I get one of those? Yeah. You know?
Well, Jimmy Smith, Jimmy McGriff, those guys were all, that was their bread and butter, was playing the Hammond B3.
Yeah, nothing sounds better.
That's right. Let's listen to some Hammond B3 show. Oh, John, by the way, it's September.
Yes.
And I thought we'd dedicate this day to kind of catching you up on the interwebs. Because you don't have solid internet access. You go to your public library like a good American. And you,
when I want to look something up on YouTube or I put in my earbuds and I watch.
So we're gonna introduce you because it is September and this is apropos.
What is September?
It's September now. It's September.
But I mean, what's the connection?
You'll see in a minute because I'm bad at segues. I just jam that square peg into that round hole with a sledgehammer.
You go, hey, how about that?
Yeah, and so you know what a mashup is, John?
Yes, I know.
Okay, you know what a mashup is, right?
That goes back about 25 years.
You take
years.
Two songs that don't go together.
Yes, mash them all up. You remember the first one I ever heard was Radiohead. It was A Day in the Life. The Beatles, A Day in the Life with Paranoid Android, I think, or something.
Oh, yeah. Radiohead. Yeah, I remember
so
that.
So mashups go back a good 30 years.
Here we go.
I think.
I know. Sometimes I feel like I have to hold your hand and bring up.
Have to needle me.
No.
It was a needle.
Are you trying to needle me, eh? What are you two birds sucking around for? What's that from?
I don't know, but it's
Maltese Falcon. All right.
Two Ward, birds.
Yeah, he tells Ward Bond and the other detective. What are you two birds sucking around for? Tell somebody that. Here
That's
we go.
Hilarious.
Here's a mashup for you. That's right.
Beautiful. That's great.
Here it comes. We got John.
Who did that?
It's on line credited to someone as DJ Cummerbund.
God, that's great.
Are you ready for the big...
That's perfect.
Are you ready for the... First of all, you gotta love Earth, Wind, and Fire.
God.
how do you not love that?
That's seamless.
And then you have our favorite. You know, we're big Aussie fans here.
That's incredible.
We're big Aussie heads. I wanted someone to do War Pigs. War Pigs, and what would you put with War Pigs?
God.
Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head.
There you go, God. That'd be great.
By the way, since the Butch Cassidy episode, cannot get that song out of my head.
Yeah. It's like it's a small world. It's tough. Once it's like an earworm. Once it's in your head, it's tough to get rid of.
John, Rain how do you feel? Let me ask you a question. How do you feel about the Mike Curb congregation? How do you feel about that?
I don't know much about them. I know roughly what the era was. Wasn't he eventually lieutenant governor?
Is that true?
Yeah, I think he was lieutenant governor under Brown.
Like of course, under Brown.
The first time. Like in the 70s, I think.
Who else would it be? Here's why I asked.
And he's like a producer, right?
Here's why I asked you about this.
Yeah.
The Mike Curb congregation.
Yeah.
We talked about the possibility. We floated the idea of doing Kelly's Heroes on the Digital Movie Club.
Yeah.
We're coming. We know our friend Justine. Oh, by the way, the kids are in Hawaii. So this is the Hawaiian episode where the two leads don't go to Hawaii. So the Bradys are all in Hawaii. You got Jake and Patrick and Justine. And they're all and they're on separate islands. They didn't vacation together.
Well, two of them did.
Yeah, two of them get. Well, Jake, wouldn't that be funny?
They're all in different islands. Yeah. Well, not, yeah. Not Patrick and Justine.
Yeah, Jake and Justine are together, and yeah. Patrick's by himself, which is weird.
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
And then they get. So are they going to meet Vincent Price?
Or Jim Backus?
Jim Backus.
Oh, that was the one where they went to the Grand Canyon.
That's, yeah, but Hawaii was Vincent Price. Who's in love with this big tiki called Arthur or something or something, and then they get the cursed amulet. Or
that's right,
the little tiki on a rope.
Was that the first episode where they all had a perm? Remember when Mike had the perm and then Greg got the perm? And
it's
then...
so weird. They came back one year and they all had perms. It was like crazy. That's the same year like the Dodgers. Half the Dodgers got perms. That was a thing. I look it up in the 70s. All of a sudden you're like, what? I don't get it. Why does everybody have like tight curly hair now? It's like that just became a thing. Like,
yeah, for a little while.
75, right?
Earlier. 72, 73, right in there.
I mean, they come back and like the intro, they've all got it. And you're like, what?
It was weird. It was okay for Greg to have it, but Mike?
I don't know, get it. I don't know what the decision was, but I guess a lot of people were doing it. I know, yeah, truly, a bunch of the Dodgers did it.
You know, well, Don Sutton always had a little bit of a perm. And
that's crazy. They go to Hawaii.
Jerry
they,
Royce?
They have all these misadventures, so we'll see what the kids, when they come.
Yeah, I want to hear about the tiki gods. And
Do they meet Don Ho? I love that, because that becomes one of the curses. You know, Greg wipes out, you know, Alice puts her foot in a bucket, and the kids meet Don Ho, you know, remember?
Yeah, that's
they're
right.
Like walking, they're walking past a restaurant, and they're like, hey, look, it's Don Ho. And you're thinking, first of all, would kids that age know who Don Ho is?
Yeah, that's it.
Tiny bubbles.
That's it.
In the wine.
He's the voice of Hawaii, Hawaii.
And then when Charlie's Angels go to Hawaii, they meet Don Ho. They
Is
always
that true?
Meet Don Ho. Yeah.
Love Boat? They had to love. He had to have been
Charlie's
on the
Angels for sure. He's trying to like give Kate Jackson a drink. She's like, oh, no, I'm on the job. Okay, I'll drink yours then. Tiny bubble.
God, how do you remember that?
I don't know. Don Ho.
Your childhood was magical.
No, it was just parked in front of a TV half the time. Magical. Just watched way too much TV.
So we were talking about anachronistic music, like in Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head.
That would be genius. You put that with War Pigs or Highway to Hell or something.
Hey, that's a
See,
good
one. AC/DC is perfect. You can put that with anything.
You were saying you don't like Butch Cassidy because of the music.
Yeah, it kind of killed it for
and
me.
And then I
yeah.
was saying yeah. Kelly's Heroes for me never quite worked because you have the hippie character.
Yeah.
Well, I forgot. When I bought my copy of Where Eagles Dare, it came with a copy of Kelly's Heroes.
Really?
Like a double feature.
Really?
So the other day I said, I'm going to try to rewatch this. Maybe I've judged it incorrectly all these years. In the very beginning, you have to get this great sequence where Clint Eastwood, they've captured this German officer, and they're waiting in a Jeep behind German lines, and nobody knows they're there. And then all of a sudden, when they're found out, there's like this. They just take off speeding through the German lines. And you're like, wow, what a great opening. Until as soon as they take off, you hear a little something like this.
That's in the movie?
That's how the movie opens.
I don't remember that.
That's it.
Wow. I must have just like purged that from my memory. Yeah. That's the opening.
Yeah. The Jeep is like driving behind enemy lines. And
well, it was a comedy, wasn't it?
It was.
It's really a comedy.
Well, here's the thing. But here's where I was thinking with... Yeah. Let me ask you... I kind of busted us, John.
I need to watch it again.
But let me tell you why. Here's why. Here's why you and I are hypocrites. You know why?
Why?
We get mad at BJ Thomas and Raindrops Keep Falling. We get mad at that. And then
BJ
Thomas. And then Quentin Tarantino puts cat people in Inglourious Basterds, and you and I are just like, that is so great.
Yeah, you're right. We're hypocrites. Yeah. You're right, because I don't care if it's anachronistic as long as it works.
Yeah.
And yeah, so for me, yeah, Raindrops Keep Falling in My Head doesn't work, but it's okay to have David Bowie doing his thing during a World War II,
yeah,
you know, freak out where they're burning down the theater with Nazis inside.
It's okay if we like it. It's like anything else.
We're like, oh, it works. Yeah. It's like, well, for most of the population, Raindrops Keep Falling in My Head works for Rich Cassidy.
Yeah, except you and I.
Yeah.
We're the only two.
We're hypocrites.
Yeah. High five.
High five. Yes. Smack.
High five. On the low.
So are we going to put that on the list, Kelly's Heroes?
I don't know. I'm up in the... You know, I think I want to do it just for Justine.
Because it is a comedy. It's really a comedy.
Telly Savalas is great in it.
They're all great.
And
as I recall, I need to watch it again, but as I recall, it was a good movie.
Don Rickles is in it. Why aren't we watching?
And he's very good in that. Mm. He's very good. You know the one we really should watch, now that I'm thinking of it? If you want to freak out Justine now that she's really into Clint Eastwood, the one we really should ever watch is Paint Your Wagon.
I told her. I was going to tell her last week. It's on Amazon Prime right now.
That is a weird one.
Yeah.
I saw that for the first time a couple of years ago. That is a weird one.
Well, because it's Lerner and Lowe.
It's a real musical.
The guys,
it was a stage musical.
Yeah, the guys that wrote My Fair Lady, and you have Clint Eastwood singing and Lee Marvin.
Lee Marvin singing. And actually, Lee Marvin's not bad.
Yeah.
Who would have thought he could really carry a tune? Yeah. It's really weird, that scene where Clint Eastwood is walking through the field going, I gave my love a flower.
Yeah.
Something like that. You're going, God, this looks like a shampoo commercial.
That's it.
You can't believe it.
Check it out.
It's the only time he tried something like that, I think.
Who's in Cat Ballou? Oh, no, that's Lee Marvin as well, isn't it?
And he got an Oscar.
Yeah. Is there singing in that?
Yeah, but you know who does the singing? It's Nat King Cole and Stubby Kay.
Oh, that's right.
They're like the Greek chorus.
That's right.
I've never seen Cat Ballou, but boy, I think that's the one Lee Marvin got the Oscar, and it's really a big one.
We should check it out.
It's supposed to be a great Western comedy. Jane Fonda.
I've never seen it.
But Paint Your Wagon is really odd. It's just so odd.
But you can tell in the chorus that it's got that Lerner and Lowe feel. It's got that My Fair Lady feel.
Yeah. And it's one of the last Hollywood musicals. They just couldn't make them work. You know, stuff like Hello, Dolly. And they kept doing these musicals, and they just didn't work anymore. It was just they're past their time as far as making it work on film. Ugh. Think of all the flop musicals, you know. Big budget, you know.
Here's Clint Eastwood with I Talk to the Trees from Cat Ballou.
Oh, this is Paint Your Wagon?
Oh, I'm sorry, from Paint Your Wagon.
This is it, isn't it? Walking through the field.
French horns, John.
Unbelievable.
This is available on Amazon Prime right now if you want to watch it for free.
So weird. I talk to the
trees. You punk!
But they don't listen to
you. You feel lucky. Tree.
I talk to the stars, but
he's
they
not
never
bad.
Hear me.
Come on,
he's not
the
terrible.
Breeze hasn't time.
It's not what you want to see Clint Eastwood do.
No.
To stop and hear what I say.
Nobody puts ketchup
on
a hot dog.
I talk to them all in vain.
Go ahead, Tree. Make my day.
But suddenly my world.
Clint, man, he's right in there.
The surprise, yeah, he can actually carry a tune. It's just not what you want to see him do. It's weird. But the weird thing is that Lee Marvin actually is pretty damn good.
Yeah.
Pretty damn good.
And
he's got the right timber.
It's amazing that you get two big screen tough guys and they're doing this.
I know. Who's tougher than those guys? And they're musical comedy.
It would be like if you had Schwarzenegger and Stallone in the 80s decide they're going to do a musical together. You know?
So
that would have been awesome.
I'd love to know more about how that happened. Somebody must have said, we need two real Western guys, not just two.
Like, yeah.
We don't want just like, John Raitt or one of those guys. We need a real Western tough guy to do
this. Check it out. Paint Your Wagon. It's a weird movie just because it's like, who was it for?
I know. That's the thing. I remember watching it and thinking, well, if you're into musicals, this isn't exactly up your alley. And if you're into Westerns, this isn't exactly up your alley. So you ended up offending both camps.
Well, John, we've already scratched the surface of the movies. another horrible segue.
But the Mike Curb Congregation, whenever I think I've heard of them, and I think whenever I think of them, I think of the Disneyland group, the Kids of the Kingdom, that would come out in matching clothes and do this sort of like real white bread, hits of the day. Remember that? The Kids of the Kingdom?
How about this? This is my Curb Congregation as well.
It's a small world after all.
Jesus.
It's a small world after all. It's a small world.
You know, we're never going to get that out of our head.
Raindrops keep falling on my head.
I know. How do you remove an earworm? With another earworm.
With another, yeah. And then you keep moving up until you get to a good song.
It's amazing there was a market for that, but I guess in the mid-60s, there was still people that would buy something like that. The other one was that Johnny Mann stand up and sing from the 70s. It's all sort of a retread of Mitch Miller, where you've got like, 100 people up there singing a cappella, it's just crazy.
I don't know, man.
It's odd.
So, John, there's a little thing going around online right now, and these things kind of morph and come back. And I actually got tagged in one, and I did it for 4 days, and then I didn't continue it. But it was, you were supposed to post a clip of a movie that meant something to you. It was just 10 movies, a movie that had some sort of impact on your life in one way or another, or a movie that has stayed with you years. So it's not necessarily your best.
Or your favorites.
It's just a movie that in one way or another had some sort of impact on your life. And I told you to do 10 of those. And then I thought we'd be fun with you, especially, to do 10 albums.
Yeah, yeah.
So
we'll do these lists at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, of course. John will be like, give me a minute. He'll put his cheeseburger down. And
that's right. Hey, how you doing? Hey, what's your favorite 5 songs? Okay.
Hold on.
You got an hour?
Oh, yeah, here we
All
go.
All right. Okay, in the beginning.
Yeah, mm-hmm. What era? What label?
I know. We used to do that at the record store, and it would be all day. We'd start with 10, and by the end of the day, I swear to God, we were up to 100. Okay, 10 from each decade, 10 from each country, 10 from each genre. And we're like, God, I just said, what's your favorite 10? Not what your favorite 110.
Give me your 10 favorite movies of all time. All right.
And you as well.
John, so yeah, these are just going to be movies that in one way or another have stayed with us or just kind of,
yeah.
Doesn't need to be any story to it. I mean, hopefully there will be, because it's a podcast and we're trying to eat up time. But I see these lists go by sometimes and I always wonder, hey, how John would answer this. And since you don't have any internet access, I'm bringing the questions.
Now I
do
what
you.
You're saying.
You know what I'm saying?
So on this thing, they're posting clips?
Yeah. So some people are just posting or pictures.
That's
or
cool.
Just a still.
That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. So give me one. Throw your first one out there, John.
All right. I kind of got it down to 10.
Yeah.
I'll start with the first movie I saw in a theater as a kid. The first time anybody took me to the movies. So I was probably like 5 or 6.
Okay.
Maybe even younger, maybe 4, but they were re-releasing Snow White.
Oh,
that's the first time I saw something on the big screen, and that's pretty eye-popping.
Yeah,
because up until then I'd just seen movies on TV on a black and white TV.
Wow,
like I remember seeing Wizard of Oz, still being blown away, but it was on a little black and white television.
So you never got that conversion to color?
I didn't until I was like in junior high or something. We got a color TV and I'm like, oh, wow, that's really something, you know? And then you see it on a big screen, you go, oh, okay. But I, like at 4 years old, seeing that on a little black and white set, I was still blown away. I'm like, Jesus, look at this thing.
Yeah.
I mean, Wizard of Oz still has the ability to blow you away.
Yes.
If you're four and it's the first thing you're watching on TV.
I went to see it in IMAX when they re-released it in IMAX. And they did it in 3D and I was kind of worried that it was going to... It actually made it look like a play because of the way everything's shot and the way everything's framed. You know, you always have stuff in the foreground, and then you have the stage wall way in the back. You know, there's a depth of field.
Right.
It made it look like you were watching a stage production, and it really worked.
Yeah, because all the backgrounds are painted. In those days, it was all painted flat.
And then you have the three-color Technicolor.
Yeah.
So all of your primary colors really pop, you know? So
yeah.
It was a really beautiful experience. I'm glad I did it.
Yeah, I should have checked that out.
Yeah, it was cool. But Snow White.
Yeah. So until I think I'd also seen like Gulliver's Travels, the animated Gulliver's Travels on TV. TV, also black and white, also a mind blower, you know, when you're 4 years old, because it's rotoscoped. I didn't know why it was so creepy, and it's because Gulliver is rotoscoped, which is what they did before digital. If they wanted something to look really lifelike in animation, they would actually trace over live action footage. Like Disney would use it as a reference point. Like here, we'll have this girl dancing. Now we'll sort of like use it as a reference for when we're doing her Snow White dancing. With something like Gulliver's Travels, they are pretty much tracing footage of this guy walking around in the clothes that Gulliver wears.
And it gives it that kind of creepy look.
Yeah, like. And it's creepy because all the shadows, like when the little Lilliputians, you know, when they tie him down and then he gets loose and they build a fire and all the shadows are flickering on his face, you're going, he doesn't look like the rest of these little characters. They look like cartoon characters with big noses. He is like this real guy. And the shadows are hitting his face like... And you do, when you're four, you're like, why is this so creepy? Then you realize they traced this actor walking around doing the action, and then they animate it, and then they add all the other stuff around him. So so I'd seen all that on TV in black and white. So the first thing I ever saw on the big screen was Snow White. I think my mom and dad took me.
And you were blown away.
Yeah, because it's a hell of a thing. It's a masterpiece to begin with. The animation's amazing. It's so colorful, and it's got some scary parts. Again, if you're four, all that stuff with the witch, you know, the queen turning into the witch before your eyes, you know, and the thing with the poison apple, and
sure,
you know, with the skull's head on the apple and all that stuff, and the hunters going out to carve her, you know, her heart out and all that stuff, you know. Pretty cool. And then all the stuff with the dwarves. When you're four, that you're the target audience.
Sure.
All that stuff with the dwarves and Dopey and all that.
Yeah, of course.
So yeah, that was a mind blower. And I think that's the very first thing I saw on the big screen. So that would have to be the big one.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about it before. It's also my favorite movie. But Star Wars, that's definitely on my list for the same reason.
Yeah.
You know, I've never been to the movies. I remember being...
Is that your first time?
Yeah.
Wow.
First Star Wars.
That's great.
I remember being... We went to the theater on Downey Avenue in Downey. There were two theaters across the street from each
other.
Yes. And I think the one there that played Star Wars is now like a thrift store or something.
Uh-huh.
And it was the old type where the box office was out front.
Yep.
And I remember we got there and my dad said, there was a line around the block. And it was like afternoon. It was like in the middle of the afternoon. There was a line around the block and my dad went up and I remember they said something about, you know, we're all sold out. You have to come back at like, you know, 8 o'clock or whatever. And this dad came up, this other guy came up, he said, my son is sick. And do you want our tickets? It's for the next show and you can have our place. But my son, he got sick and had to go. So we ended up getting that guy's tickets.
Wow.
And
that's heavy.
And I remember walking to that theater. I remember they sold a comic book that my dad bought me of the movie.
Yeah.
And I had read the whole thing before the movie had started. I sat there but I remember being fascinated by the lights on the ground so you could walk in.
Yeah.
I had never been in a theater before. It was just a weird...
God, what a great movie.
And then lights go dark and that spaceship goes over your head and that's it. Like a nerd is born.
So, how old were you?
Four. If I had to be four or five.
Wow, how
great
is that?
Five. I was probably five.
That's amazing. That's a great way to lose your movie virginity.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Wow.
What a way.
Yeah, because boy, that makes an impression when that first ship goes overhead.
What a world. What a world.
Yeah, it's a Mickey movie fan for life.
All right, let's go. Let's do you wanna alternate between movie and let's do the movies first, and then we'll get to the albums.
Yeah.
I might not chime in on the albums just because depending on how long we take with the movies, but we definitely want to get movies out of there. So what's your next one, John?
Let's see. If we're going in some sort of like roughly chronological order, I guess that's the way to go. You said no particular order. Mm-hmm. But if we're going like in order of age when I saw them, I guess as I get older, I guess the big knockout when I'm like a preteen is like all the old Universal stuff. So, you know, that would be like Bride of Frankenstein and the original Frankenstein and The Invisible Man and King Kong, you know, which is RKO, but all that stuff. I think I saw King Kong before I saw any of them. And that was a real mind blower because, again, probably like 4 years old, had no idea how they were doing it. Mm-hmm. You're seeing this thing and you really have no concept. You're like, how are they doing that?
Yeah.
How is this thing as big as a building? You know, it's really freaky. And also the music is really... really pulls you in, that bum bum bum, you know. Yeah. Sort of. But yeah, and then Bride of Frankenstein is the one that just really knocks me out because it's there's so much going on, and the he's just created this whole other world, you know, with the sets and the makeup and the photography and all that. It just that's always, whenever we do these lists, Bride of Frankenstein's always on there.
Yeah.
So I'd say the second one is like Bride of Frankenstein, and that's the knockout. You know, because you just, every detail is pulling you in.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I'm close to you for my second one. This is a movie that I would literally, anything I was, well, I'm gonna have to, you know what, before I do that, I'm gonna add Wizard of Oz, and I'll tell you why I'm gonna add, because I'm kind of doing this as I go. Wizard of Oz was a movie I think I've talked about on the podcast before. When John and I were kids, if something was on TV, it was on once a year. Wizard of Oz would be around Easter time. They would always run it around Easter time. It would be on once a year.
And they had a host.
And if you missed it,
yeah,
you're screwed, kid.
If you fall asleep or you're sick or you're out of town, you got to wait another 12 months.
Yep. That's it. You're screwed. And so
it was an event.
We used to go to my Aunt Virginia's, all of my cousins. We would all be there at my Aunt Virginia's, and we would all sit in front of that TV and watch that, and we would just wait. We'd wait for all of the songs. We'd wait for, you know, you knew when it was coming. You're waiting for the Cowardly Lion. Yeah. I need that comedy relief.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And, you know, we loved it. We loved it. And, it was a huge event in my family to get together and watch that, The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, yeah. It's true. Every year, you'd wait, you know, and you'd see the ads, you know, and you'd be in TV Guide, and like, here it comes. And they'd, early on, they'd have, like, hosts. They'd have, like, Danny Kaye. Or trying to think who else. Sometimes Ray Bolger, I think. They'd make a big, big fat deal about it. And they'd have like a host who'd come on and go, okay, here we go. It's our 20th trip down the Yellow Brick Road, you know. They started doing it like in the 50s and just did it every year until just recently. Until the rise of cable, and you had stations playing it every day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or DVD, and then you have it. When Isabella was a kid, I used to try to make it special. And we wouldn't watch it all the time. It was a movie that we would watch. Like, here, we're going to watch this. It's like It's a Wonderful Life is for me now. Every Christmas it comes out, but I don't watch it. Elf, I'll watch it at Christmas time. Yeah. But
that's kind of the way it was with the Grinch and Rudolph.
Yeah.
You know, they play them only once a year. Sure. If you missed it, you missed it.
You're waiting for them.
You're waiting
for Charlie Brown Christmas.
Yeah.
I want to hear some jazz on TV. You get to hear it once a year.
But it's weird now because a kid can pop that in every day during Christmas vacation. He can pop it in every day.
That's it.
Yeah.
No, we don't allow that at all.
I won't allow it.
What is that? What is next for you, John?
Let's see now. Kind of got them scrawled all over the place here. So another one, as I'm getting to be like in sixth, seventh grade, would have been the original Planet of the Apes.
There you go.
That's just a knockout. Again, and my buddy Alex and I, we were just obsessed with that movie. It was kind of like, that's another one. There was a time before cable where some of these movies were big deals on broadcast television. They'd build an entire night around it and make it a great big deal, and that was one of them. Also, the James Bond movies, they did that too.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be the big Friday night movie or Saturday night movie, and with commercials, they'd pad it out to like 3 hours, and they'd make it a really big deal because it's the only way you were going to see it if it's not being revived. You know, at the second run theaters, this is the only way you're going to see it. Is like Channel 7, 8 o'clock on Saturday night.
That's how a lot of these movies came to me.
So Planet of the Apes, we were just obsessed with it. So by that time, you know, they would run all of them. You know, the first one was the one that really stuck with us, but they'd run all of them. Then it became a TV show. Then it was an animated show. They had a comic book, a magazine. They were, you know, all the merchandise and stuff. We just really, really got into it. But the first one is the one that I remember the first time I saw that on TV. And yeah, it's like a whole, it just pulls you into this whole other world.
A movie I would, another one that would, along in that vein, that I would wait for every year was King Kong. King Kong would come on maybe once a year. And it wasn't like the other movies, like either like War of the Gargantuans, which would run like eight times, you know. King Kong was like an event, and it was always kind of billed as like this event. And it was, and even though it was, you know, when you're a kid, it doesn't matter if a movie's in black and white. I'm seeing monsters, and he's punching dinosaurs. And who doesn't want that? And, you know, there were a lot of monster movies, but King Kong was, is, you know, as old as it was. And when you're a little kid, you don't understand why, like you said about the rotoscoping, you don't understand why King Kong moves the way he does, or his fur moves the way he does, or you don't understand about the intricacies of stop motion.
Right.
You know there's some kind of trickery, but you just don't understand it.
Exactly. You figure it out pretty quick as you get older, and you see other things like 1 million years BC. Or Gumby, and they say, here's how they're doing it. He's little, and they're moving around.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
But it's the music that, so many people have written about that, it's the music that makes him feel so big. You know, that Max Steiner score is so ominous.
Yeah.
And all-encompassing. And every time that music comes on, that's what makes you feel the weight of his footsteps.
Yeah.
And before he's even in the frame, it's like, uh-oh, here he comes. It's the perfect score.
It is good.
I think it's the first movie that has a 100% score. Up until then, they were kind of like dipping their toe in the water. They'd have a little music at the beginning.
Maybe kind of like Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah, and stuff some like incidental that. Music. But this is the one where they had a complete score for every scene.
And they finally really just released that recently.
Yeah.
It was unavailable for a long time.
Yeah, because I think it was tough to restore the, they would have like an orchestra would go in and perform the score from the sheet music. Now they're finding ways to kind of clean up the actual score.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good stuff. King Kong.
Yeah, that's a great one.
And that's every, you know, that pretty much launches me into that genre of, you know.
And Fay Wray screaming her brains out. That's the other thing that sells it. This has got to be something enormous because she is just freaking out, you know.
That is true.
Yeah.
Yeah, you see him scream. You see. He's getting closer.
I know. That's also the first time you realize, wow, this is like another time, right?
Yeah.
Those scenes at the beginning where she's trying to steal an apple and you see the soup, you know, the bread line for the soup kitchen. And that's one of the first times where we're going, oh, this is almost like a history lesson. Of course, you're not thinking that at five. But seeing something like King Kong or Little Caesar or The Public Enemy, you go, oh, this is like, this is not the way things look now. All those people in line to get, you know, to get bread and soup and, you know, the way they're all wearing fedoras and you know, all that stuff around the Empire State Building, you're going, oh, this is different.
Yeah.
You know,
I was just flipping through the channels yesterday and Vertigo was on.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's Jimmy Stewart in his car spying on Kim Novak and he's got a fedora on. I'm like, look at that. The 50s just walking around in your hat. Like,
I know.
You know, it's like normal.
I know.
All the women have hats.
You get out of the car, everybody's wearing a fedora and all the women have gloves. They're all wearing like, you know, gloves and high heels.
Yeah.
And, it's so weird.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the Grapes of Wrath, everybody's got a hat on.
Mm.
Except for Pa.
Yeah.
You know, they're all wearing hats.
Yeah.
Got a cap, some kind of cap or a hat.
That's right. Everybody.
Or a head covering.
The newsboy's got a cap.
Yeah,
on, you know?
Sure.
Everybody, yeah. Mm.
All right. What do you got next, John?
Let's see now. Okay, this is another one that me and my buddy Alex were just obsessed with. We just, this one they would run sometimes more than once a year. So we, anytime it was on, we just completely glommed onto this was the original Poseidon Adventure.
Oh, I used to love that one. I was like, sure.
Still one of my all-time favorites, and it's just such a journey, you know? Just you get a little set up at the beginning, and then once that boat flips, you are just there. You are there with them, and you're trying to figure out who's going to make it and who's not.
And you know they're not all going
to
make it.
And again, it's pre-digital. I mean, they had these sets with water being pumped in and people falling over backwards off of tables, and you know, that stuff was staged. It was not done digitally. So it's, you know, there's something to that.
I was a big fan of the disaster movie when I was a kid. Poseidon, Towering Inferno.
Earthquake.
Anything with Irwin Allen could do no wrong. And then you get older, you're like, Boy, these are not that good, but Poseidon Adventure holds up.
I was talking to my brother the other day about this, and we realized the only one that really holds up out of all of those, because he had recently watched Earthquake, and he said, God, that is really a bad movie.
Yeah, it's horrible.
He says, why is it so awful? There's all these great people in it. And I reminded him, Towering Inferno had Paul Newman, Steve McQueen, William Holden. It was an all-star cast. Faye Dunaway, all-star cast. It's not a particularly good movie. It's not particularly well-written.
No.
It's pretty cheesy. You got all these people, all these famous faces, but it's just, you're just there to see the building burn.
Exactly.
You know? And how are they going to get off the roof? And that's what pulls you in. Earthquake is really awful. Most of the airport movies are not very good. The first one is good because it's got an A cast and an A director. Out of all those disaster movies, yeah, we just loved watching those. That was a thing. The only one that holds up as an A picture, a good picture, is The Poseidon Adventure. It's well written. You got good actors doing a good job, and you completely believe the action. You completely believe they're in danger, you know, trying to get through the engine room is on fire, or you have to swim underneath all the wreckage, or, you know, kick in a door. It all looks like it's really happening.
Yeah.
And you feel this. And the thing that is, it's genius for suspense, is that the boat just keeps sinking. Like, we have to climb faster. We got all these obstacles. We have to get to the top faster because this thing keeps sinking. It's filling up with water. It just keeps dropping. So every time they get to another level, they're like, we got to move faster.
Ah.
Gene Hackman is great. He's really hamming it up, but he's really great. I mean, it almost suits the character because he's he's a minister, he's a preacher, you know. And Ernest Borgnine's great. Everybody is great in that. So, yeah, that's one that just really, to this day, they've remade it a couple times, and nothing touches the original.
Shelley Winters,
yeah. Christ, she was up for an Oscar for that. I mean, everybody in that is great.
What is the song from that?
There's Got to Be a Morning After.
That's it.
It's supposed to be Carol Lynley is a singer on the boat. It's not her singing. It's like Maureen McGovern or something.
Okay.
Or, yeah.
Here's our friend Renee.
That might have won an Oscar. It was up for an Oscar. Somebody on Oscar night came out and sang that song.
That is great.
But that was a great one. Oh, even Leslie Nielsen's in it.
Oh, he's the captain, isn't he?
He's the captain, so he doesn't live past the when the tidal wave hits them. He's like the first to go because he's on the bridge. He's on the bridge with, and he's got his binoculars. And when he sees the size of the tidal wave, he goes, "Oh my god!" And the next thing you know, he's the first one to go. You know.
There's got to be a morning after.
There we go.
If we can hold on through the night.
This is, of course, the opening to The Dirty Dozen.
We have a chance to find the sunshine.
Boy, the 70s, huh?
Let's keep on looking for the light.
So it's Carol Lynley lip-syncing to that. What's great, there's a scene where they're rehearsing this before, you know, it's like the day before the party, and they're all on the boat. Roddy McDowall plays...
oh, that's right!
He plays like a waiter on the boat, or a valet or something, and so he's helping set up for the New Year's Eve party, and he hears them singing that song, and one of the other waiters goes, "Ugh, what do you think of this modern music? Ugh." And Roddy McDowall goes, "I rather fancy it." And you're going, it's a great line. And then you're thinking, this isn't particularly offensive. It's not Led Zeppelin or Black Sabbath. It's just a girl singing. And he's all, oh, this modern music. I rather fancy it. I rather fancy a planet run by apes.
Zira.
We used to go, how come all our favorite movies, Roddy McDowell's?
Zira. Oh, Poseidon's a good one. That is a good one. Another movie that I would wait for on television. And this was my favorite kaiju movie when I was a kid. It's terrible. It's easily the worst.
I'm laughing already.
It was, but it had two of my favorite characters of all time. That's right. King Kong versus Godzilla. I would wait for that. That's all I wanted. King Kong didn't even look like King Kong.
I know. You're like, that's not our King Kong. That's not 1933 King Kong.
Whose King Kong is that? But it was great. I love it. And I think they stole the music from Creature from the Black Lagoon. I think
it's possible.
They may have used it in there.
That's so crazy. I know Universal did that. They'd reuse all that music, but maybe Toho did it.
Yeah. I think it was da-da-da, da-da-da. You know that little?
Yeah.
Da-da-da. Or as they did on Mystery Science Theater, here I am. I'm the creature. Good stuff. King Kong versus Godzilla. Seek it out. Not one of the best Godzilla movies, but it's pretty great.
And then we were always fascinated as kids. You know, they reran that. Actually, it was crazy. The old Whittier Theater, they reran that.
Oh, yeah.
Were you there?
No.
They reran it. It was a weird thing. They were trying to do, like, in the early 70s, they did a thing where they were trying to do a thing like the old days. They showed a bunch of cartoons, a bunch of Three Stooges shorts, and then they ran as the main feature King Kong versus Godzilla. And we were fascinated by the idea that when they showed it in Japan, there's supposedly a different ending where Godzilla wins.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true.
That is not true, but it was an urban legend.
Myth, yeah.
It's catastrophic. A titanic, terrifying battle between the mightiest monsters of all time. King, there it is. Did you hear it?
The great Godzilla, blazing a trail of terror to his Japanese homeland.
Captain Warren Conning Tower.
Godzilla!
Roaring defiance to the only enemy on Earth strong enough to challenge him. The unconquerable King Kong, giant gorilla god of this South Seas paradise, where sensuous maidens offer themselves in ritual sacrifice to his crude embrace.
Japanese people in blackface.
About this size. He is sheer brute force. While Kong is a thinking animal. His brain is considerably larger.
By the way, the newscaster is played by Ralph Meeker.
Really?
Yeah.
I was going to say.
We last saw him in Dirty Dozen. Destroy one another.
King Kong versus Godzilla, heading for their colossal collision, shattering every obstacle that stands between them in the most fantastic rampage of annihilation ever recorded on film. See King Kong stamp Tokyo into the ground, holding a beautiful girl in his grasp. Godzilla destroy an entire army. See King Kong trapped by the blazing barrier of a billion volts. But nothing, nobody can stop the great showdown when King Kong and Godzilla meet to fight for survival of the fittest.
Man.
So great.
Here's a little memory. Speaking of black and white TVs, when my parents moved into the house where my mom lives now, I was probably in third grade. And my brothers were painting the living room, and I remember watching this movie on a black and white TV in the living room that we brought from our other house. While they were painting, I was sitting in the living room on the concrete because they were redoing the carpet. And I remember just sitting there watching that movie on a black and white TV on KTLA. Yeah,
it's amazing how you can get pulled in.
Yeah,
especially if you don't know that large color sets exist.
Yeah.
You just get pulled right in.
Oh, you're no, like, it was funny. We had a color set at the house, but in our bedroom, I shared a bedroom with both of my brothers.
Yeah,
we had a little black and white TV, so I remember watching whatever my brothers were watching. I was watching, and it was in black and
white.
That's
right. Most families would have a little portable somewhere in the house.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't in the main TV room.
No,
yeah, exactly.
No, but it wasn't like this. We had two color TVs.
Yeah.
It wasn't like that. It was like you have an old TV.
Yeah.
And that TV was literally portable. My dad would take it out to the garage to watch like UCLA games on Saturdays.
Yeah, they'd have like a little handle.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you'd carry it.
Yep.
Like a little suitcase.
That's it, yeah.
God, in those days, you're like, wow, how high tech?
Yeah.
How high tech can you get?
That's
if somebody had told us then, you'll be able to watch it on your watch.
Yeah.
You know, you'll be able to watch this on your phone. You'll pull it out of your pocket. And you want to watch Planet of the Apes, just pull it out of your pocket and watch it anytime.
Imagine someone trying to imagine like a phone, like back in those days, like a rotary phone. What do you mean I'm going to watch it on my phone?
What?
How?
That would have been a mind blower. Everybody. And if somebody had said everybody is going to have one of these in their pocket. They pull it out and use it as a phone, use it as a TV, use it as a computer.
All right. You know what's funny? There's a question for John Sandy that's coming up that is right along those lines. But let's get to those movies, John.
let's get to those movies.
We're about halfway through. The next one coming up. Here we go. What's your next one?
Let's see here. Something's got to go. I think I got more than 10 here.
That's okay. Something's got to give, huh?
Yeah, let's see. Well, it would have to be the Python movies. I guess I have like a two-way tie between Monty Python and the Holy Grail and Life of Brian.
Okay.
And yeah, so that's about the time I guess I'm getting into junior high or high school. And, you know, you've seen all the comedies that you usually see on TV. You know, everything that they're running on Channel 5. You know, you got the Three Stooges, you got the Hope and Crosby pictures, the Marx Brothers. All that stuff's great. I love the Marx Brothers so much. Had all those committed to memory. There's one station that played the Marx Brothers. They play like the Coconuts or one of those movies 5 days a week. Same with some of the Godzilla movies. I think they called it the Million Dollar Movie or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was Channel 9.
For some reason, they would run the same movie. I don't know how this worked as far as ratings go.
Yeah.
Every night, Monday through Friday at 8 o'clock, they'd run the same movie for a week. So, you know, we'd commit it to memory. If you're watching a Marx Brothers movie, by Friday, you've memorized all the one-liners.
Sure.
Or if, you know. But, yeah, so I'd say, Monty Python. Like, Holy Grail, first time I saw that, I just, you know, you almost think you're going to... You're laughing so hard you think you're going to just pass out, you know? You just can't even catch your breath.
Mm-hmm.
And they were running those on Channel 28, probably because they were having a lot of success. PBS was having a lot of success running the old Monty Python TV shows. So around 76, they started running Monty Python on the Holy Grail on PBS, like 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and they'd run the movie. And that was something you were not going to see on the network.
Sure.
And so that was a thing where we'd get everybody together like a party and watch it together. I can think of a couple times we gather up a whole group of people. Okay, it's going to be on. Here it is. And especially on PBS, you'd have no commercials. So it's as close as you were going to get to cable at that point.
Sure.
Yeah. And just laughing our heads off. We had the Monty Python albums. We were watching the TV show. But to see this was just like pulling out all the stops. You know. And that's, of course, everybody that's a Python fan has committed that movie to memory. It's just the thing. Every scene is quotable. Every scene is so out there that you just commit the whole thing to memory.
That's great.
All the stuff, you know, the coconuts from the first scene where they come through the fog and instead of horses, they got the coconuts.
Yeah.
You know.
It's funny. I have a comedy here too, and it was really up in the air because I want to say Airplane, but I didn't see Airplane until much later.
Yeah.
I was exposed at an early age because I had a lot of older brothers and uncles to Blazing Saddles, which I saw way before I probably should have. But boy, did it make me laugh.
Oh, and, yeah.
You know, a lot of the stuff, you know, just goes right over your head because you're a little kid. But punching the horse and there's certain things that are just hilarious. Even when you're a little kid.
It works on two levels.
It works on a lot of levels.
It's like The Simpsons. It works on two
levels.
And
it's so slapsticky and so...
So cartoony. Yeah. When you're older, you get all the sex jokes.
Yeah, my uncle probably showed us that when I was maybe like 10 years old.
Yeah.
9 or 10. And Airplane came along a little later.
Yeah.
Probably pretty close, but I think... I'm pretty sure I saw Blazing Saddles first.
Yeah.
And Airplane definitely, when I saw it, was definitely... It was something like, "Oh, this is my sense of humor.
Yeah.
I like all the non sequiturs, and it's just silly." And
it's kind of like watching. It's like watching a Mad Magazine.
Sure, exactly.
When you'd read Mad Magazine, they'd do those movie parodies, and they were just so full of great one-liners and irreverent stuff. And then, so when you watch something like Blazing Saddles or Airplane, you go, "This is like a Mad Magazine come to life."
Yeah, it doesn't follow any rules.
No,
it doesn't follow.
It's all just silly. It's just silly.
Mm-hmm. And that's why when I was a kid, I would have, if you would have asked me. Name the two best Mel Brooks movie, I would have said Blazing Saddles and History of the World. I would have not have said Young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Because Young Frankenstein was more, I've said it before,
yeah.
It's more of a movie. As I'm older now,
I
really appreciate it. But Blazing Saddles was, I think, my introduction to that style.
Yeah.
Like a cartoon style of comedy. And it really...
Anything goes.
Yeah.
It's just pure laughter.
Yeah. I didn't understand why Count Basie was out in the desert. But it was cool. It looked cool. It made me want to be go out and get me some Gucci bags, you know, and be a cowboy.
No, the best stuff works on two levels. Rocky and Bullwinkle was like that, you know, and Python's like that. It's a complete mashup of the cerebral and the silly. You know, people falling down or getting hit in the face or whatever. But then you've got these great little like political jokes or philosophical jokes. I mean, you've got things you have to dig deep. That's why when you sit through Monty Python and the Holy Grail, like for the 10th time, you're going, "Oh, wow, I missed that line. They're doing this whole thing behind all the other jokes. They're doing this other thing, you know?"
Exactly.
They're just at their peak. They're done with the TV show. And they're just at the peak of their comedic powers.
Let's go on to your next one, John. What do you got, buddy?
You're
by the way, you are at your peak right now.
I don't know about that.
Mentally.
I don't know about that. Mentally. I guess while we're on this, we're on this roll, I just cannot make a list without putting a Young Frankenstein in there.
There you go.
Because if somebody says, what's the funniest movie of all time, it just depends on what day you ask me, but
Young Frankenstein is always in the top five, isn't
it? 9 times out of 10, I'm going to say that's the funniest movie ever made. Sometimes I'll say Monty Python, or I'll say Some Like It Hot, or something like that. But I think more often than not, I would say Young Frankenstein. And I've probably seen that more times than any comedy, probably.
Sure.
Even more than all the times I've seen the Marx Brothers, a million times, and Hope and Crosby and all the Mel Brooks stuff. But Young Frankenstein is probably the one I've seen the most times.
Yeah.
And I just, you know the reason I love it. I love it because it's just so funny. But on top of that, if you love all the old Universal Monster movies, it is dead on. Every joke, every visual cliche, every, you know, everything. Just, it's so dead on the way it looks, the way it's written. It's such a great tip of the hat to the old Universal Monster movie. So it works as an homage, but it's also really, just laugh for laugh, I think it's just the funniest movie ever. Just, you know.
Yeah.
And everybody is amazing. Marty Feldman, Terry Gar, Gene Wilder. Gene Hackman is only in there for 5 minutes. He's great.
Yeah.
Peter Boyle is amazing. I mean, everybody's great. Madeline Kahn, it's just it's a dream cast, you know, and just more laughs per minute than any movie I can think of.
Where are you going? Yeah. I'm just going to make espresso.
I mean, every scene, it's just so crazy.
Every scene has a great punchline.
Yeah.
It's good. It's one of my all-time favorites. It took, you know, I had to be a little older to appreciate all of the, I appreciated the silliness when I was a kid, but it just wasn't enough of it, like in Blazing Saddles.
Right.
It's basically, you realize as you get older, the humor in, I mean, there is dumb stuff in Young Frankenstein, but a lot of the humor is in Gene Hackman's, or Gene Wilder's performance, and there's just the way they skewer the original movie with love. But, you know, they're kind of making fun of the performances and that sort of thing. And it works on a lot of other levels that you don't catch when you're, you know, 7 years old.
I've run into some people who've seen it recently, like for the first time, and they're not, it doesn't knock them out. And I think because some of it is, it's just so much funnier if you have seen at least like one or two of the original Frankensteins. Mm-hmm. If you've seen even a couple of them, it just works that much better. The jokes are just that much funnier. And you can just, you know, the whole thing is just much more effective. But it's not by any means necessary. It's just a great comedy to begin with.
Staying on the comedy line, my dad was not a fan of, you know, his he was always more like an action movie, like he was a big like Clint Eastwood, Charles Bronson, that kind of guy, or he wanted to see, or like he was all about Schwarzenegger in the 80s. My dad, Stallone, loved all that stuff.
Oh wow!
Or he wanted to see like a Western or you know, something with like a good story. He didn't really like comedies per se. Or he loved sci-fi. He loved sci-fi, loved Star Wars, that kind of stuff. But he just was not a comedy. Like, he would not sit. Blazing Saddles, he thought it was funny just because it was so vulgar. But, you know, if I wanted to watch, and then a couple times when I did, I remember watching Monty Python, and he did chuckle, and he always thought British stuff was funny. So,
oh, that's cool.
But, like, if I was watching the Pink Panther or something, he would just be like, I have no time for this. Just, you know, wander off. Me and my brothers would be like cracking up, and my dad would just be like, okay, I guess. And then just like, I have no sons. But I remember back when Santa Fe Springs had that little theater.
Yeah.
They would do double features a lot. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And I had seen the commercials on it, and it must have not caught wide release because it was there pretty quick. But it was my first Coen Brothers movie. I think I was 13 or 14, maybe a little older. Me and my dad went to see something else, and it was a double feature. And it was with Raising Arizona. I don't remember what the other movie was, but Raising Arizona was. And I had seen commercials for it, and I wanted to see it so bad. Because the commercials all hyped up that chase scene in the grocery store. And it just looked like a Three Stooges movie. It looked like a crazy Three Stooges movie. And I remember going to see that. And my first of all, Nicolas Cage's accent just struck my dad. Anything with an accent, for whatever reason, my dad thought was funny. So if it was like a like somebody speaking with like a Southern accent, don't ask me why, my dad was all about it. So I think it came from when he was in the Army. He was just fascinated with
sure.
So, you know, you got Nicolas Cage doing that accent. So my dad's in. And next thing I know, I mean, 20 minutes in the movie, he's literally, I've never seen him laugh so hard. And a bunch of that reaction to that movie was watching my dad react to that movie.
Yeah.
And that movie will always have a special place in my heart just because we sat there just laughing. It was hilarious. When you're 13 or 14, that movie's the best. And it's just so out there. And so, and it was also one of the first movies where I kind of got, like, it's like they're making jokes that, like, you know, oh, I'm getting these jokes.
A little offbeat.
They're a little offbeat, yeah. And it's a little crazy. And again, it's very cartoonish in a lot of ways. But just
that's a special thing to see your dad lose it.
Yeah.
Because it's true. Most people, I think, have that where, you know, your dad's your dad, and you rarely see them just, like, you know, just laugh their ass off.
Yeah.
You know?
And he was, like, literally in tears that whole movie.
So that must
have
really stayed with
him. I had never seen him react to that.
It's a different side of your dad.
Yeah. It was really cool. And so, Raising Arizona, if you've never seen it, it's, you know, like the second or third.
It's the second.
Yeah. After
Blood Simple.
Yeah.
That was a knockout because it doesn't look like anything. Of course, now there's been a million Coen Brothers movies and people aping the Coen Brothers.
Yeah.
Blood Simple was odd because it was all these things you can do with the camera. It's just like, oh, yeah, you can really get inventive.
Yeah.
I think movies had gotten kind of boring and they said, oh, yeah, you could just do anything.
Just like Sam Raimi. Just like
Sam Raimi. Exactly. And they were buddies.
Yeah.
They were buddies with Sam Raimi.
Yeah. It's right out of that same school.
Yeah.
When you first see Evil Dead, you're like, it's scary, but then you're like, well, there's something else going on here, too.
It's the possibilities. They're like a kid in a candy store. It's like the possibilities you can have with a camera.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's amazing that Raising Arizona is like the second one. They're already just like, go, 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 you know?
I'm counting my movies. I'm not ignoring you. One, two.
Go, go, go.
Three, four.
Are we we've done six, right?
Yes.
Okay.
What do you got next, John?
Oh, boy. Some things are going to fall by the wayside here.
Yeah, I'm doing the same thing. I'm paring it down.
It's rough because I wrote probably like 20.
He's thinking.
Yeah, it's rough. Because I'm going to have to – there was a whole period where I was just watching all this Woody Allen stuff, like right out of high school, going back and watching Love and Death and Annie Hall and Manhattan and Stardust Memories and all that stuff. So it's amazing. I'm going to have to squeeze them out because, yeah, I've probably seen Love and Death a billion times. But I guess I'm going to put Dr. Strangelove in there.
There you go.
I'm glad that's one of the ones we're going to watch.
We're going to go back and watch it.
The Digital Movie Club. Because it's endlessly fascinating.
It is a good one.
It is because there's two things going on. It's really funny. And most of the time, it's funny in a real subtle way.
Yes.
You know, you remember the broader moments, like Slim Pickens on top of an atom bomb waving his hat. That's not subtle. But there are lots of moments in the film where you're just laughing because it's just Peter Sellers playing a character who's so uncomfortable. He just feels like he doesn't know what the hell to do.
Yeah.
He's trapped in a room with a madman, and he doesn't know how to talk him out of, you know, starting World War III. And then all that stuff where he's playing, you know, it's a tour de force. He's playing three different characters. He's playing a British officer, and he's playing the president of the United States. And then he's playing Dr. Strangelove himself. He's using a different accent. He's totally believable as all three characters. And it's just a real tour de force. That's
Dimitri,
the one.
One of our pilots went and did a silly thing.
Well, I'll tell you what he did. He went and no, he's just amazing.
And George C. Scott.
Oh, and see, that's the thing. As great as Peter Sellers is, and he's never been more brilliant. The lines that always stick in my head are all the George C. Scott scenes.
Yes.
You know, and just little offhanded remarks where he just slaps his stomach and goes, God, I wish we had one of those doomsday bombs. You know? That's a lot of commie crapple. You know, it's just like, or like when he's talking to his girlfriend, he sees how far things have gone, you know, and he talks to his girlfriend on the phone, he's eating a piece of gum, and he's all, be sure and say your prayers tonight, Charlie. And the story goes, he played it Kubrick kept telling him to play it broader. He's like, I don't know. He said, go broader. I'll probably pick the less broad take.
And then he would
and
pick
he says,
them.
That son of a bitch, every scene, he's taking the hammiest performance, but it works.
Yeah.
He is so great. So his greatest Peter Sellers is, the stuff that sticks in my mind is the George C. Scott stuff, the faces he makes when they're in the war room, you know. It's a great film.
Let me ask you a question, John. Have you ever heard of fluoridation?
Oh, my God. Yeah. Sterling Hayden. Everybody, and that's great. It's amazing. It's a must see. And then it's not just the laughs. It's like what's behind the laughs. When people talk about dark comedies, this is the darkest of all dark comedies because what they're trying to prevent is World War III.
Yeah.
You know, and the story goes that Kubrick was going to do this movie as a straight sort of like nuclear thriller. And he said, there's just too many scenes that are, you can mine for comedic effect. It's almost just silly. It's so frightening. It's silly. Some of these situations, which are like real situations. You get these planes in the air that refuel in the air so that they can always be like so many miles from Moscow, you know. But they played it for laughs. And so behind all the laughs, you've got this really, it's kind of like what they used to call whistling past the graveyard laughs. Yeah. You know, you're laughing so you won't cry, you know.
Say your prayers tonight, sugar.
Oh, God, yeah. George C. Scott. So... yeah, so that's to me, that's one of the all-time great comedies. And Kubrick, I think it's the only comedy Kubrick ever did. Everything else is pretty deadly serious.
Yeah, Full Metal Jacket has some comedic moments in it, but...
you wouldn't really call it a comedy.
It's not a comedy.
This one's a full-on comedy.
The Shining's pretty hilarious.
And, of course, Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's a big one. And from the first time I saw that, that's always in my top 10. It just, it's a unique movie.
You know
movie.
What's funny? Going back to my dad, he did like that movie.
Did he?
He did like that movie. I remember he would always remember Slim Pickens.
Yeah.
Because he said, he told me, he said, that's something someone from Texas would do. He told me that. He told me a story about how after the war, he was in Korea, and then after the war, you know, there was a ceasefire. And he said there were guys in his company or in his platoon or whatever from the South, and they were really sad that the war ended. They wanted they were sad that it the like, you know.
Yeah.
They were
so I know some people that's they really realize wanted, that's as good as it's ever gonna
yeah,
get.
They wanted to he said it was just a different mentality.
Mm.
You know, they were hoping anytime it was gonna, you know, kick back up again, and they just, you know, you know, this is not a comedy. It is funny, but I remember going to see this movie, and a coworker of mine asked me if I had seen this movie. I knew the director because my brother was a big fan of his first movie, but I had not seen this, and I wanted to see it because I liked the director's first movie. And I remember someone came up to me at work and said, "Have you seen this movie yet?" And I said, "No," and they said, "Please see it because I need somebody to talk about this with." So my wife and I, we weren't married yet, but we were dating. We went to see a little movie called Pulp Fiction. Boy, oh boy, to this day.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that Get Out, I think I said this last year, Get Out was the closest experience I've had to having that experience in the theater of just being absolutely blown away and not quite sure what I'm seeing. And, you know, but just enjoying it. Just loving every minute of it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, boy, that really just... And my brother was a huge fan of Reservoir Dogs. I remember I didn't see it when it came out. My brother had it on video, and he's like, "You got to check." I saw it on Siskel and Ebert, and I go, "Oh, that looks interesting," you know. Yeah. And they had raved about it. And then I kind of forgot about it. And then my brother said, "No, you got to see this movie." And I remember watching it with my brother, and it was just being blown away. And then, you know, remembering, because the guy had such a weird name, you know, Quentin Tarantino has such a weird name.
Yeah.
And then here's a couple years later, Pulp Fiction. And I don't know if you remember, John, but that movie took that movie was in theaters for months.
Oh, yeah. It's back when.
It was probably the last movie that had a run like that.
Because that's back when that's where you made your money. Now it's like streaming and DVDs and all that, cable sales. But that was like the last era where if you're going to make a lot of money, it's with something that's going to run like all summer, you know.
It ran probably for 6 months.
Yeah It was in theaters, and then it was in the second run theaters, and it just, you're right, it ran forever. We had chances to go back 2-3 times.
Yeah, I think we saw it 3 or 4 times in the theater.
It's the kind of movie you wanted to see more than once. to see if you caught everything. Mm-hmm. And because they looped back on the time frames, and you just like, there's all these little Easter eggs, you know, before you knew what an Easter egg was.
Yeah.
And all these little people just sort of like, you know, Harvey Keitel is so great. He's barely in it, but he's just wonderful, you know. Even people with just a cameo, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Quentin Tarantino's in it.
Yeah.
It's so great.
I love it.
It's so great, his little moment, you know. But you're right. That's a game-changing movie for anybody who saw that, you know. And I get the feeling that a lot of people saw that before they saw Reservoir Dogs, you know. And then they went back. They said, oh, is there more? You know, what else has this guy done? And there's only one other film. You know, or you'd watch True Lies because, or not True Lies, True Romance because he wrote it.
Yeah.
It's funny, it was hard to be a Tarantino fan there for a while because there wasn't much, you know, you were waiting for the next thing. It took him a while before he put out Jackie Brown. So you kind of just, you kept watching like, yeah, True Romance and Reservoir Dogs. But yeah, that's a big one. Yeah.
Pulp Fiction
is a big one. And that's one that would stick in anybody's memory as a movie. You've never seen a movie like that before. And every scene's memorable, and everybody in it's great.
And just it's a ride.
It's a ride. You don't have any idea how it's going to pan out. You have no idea because anybody could die. You can see.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if these guys are stars. Anybody could meet a really terrible end in this movie.
And it was funny because it probably took me a week to see it after I had this conversation. And no one else had seen it. And so finally he's like, oh my God, let's talk about it. You know. And then he just wanted to, did you see that? It was like he wanted confirmation and validation that he had seen what he had seen. It was kind of one of those conversations. And did that scene in the pawn shop really happen, or was I, you know... nope, it happened, man, you know, but boy.
I know, it was so out there.
Yeah.
So twisted. And the dialogue, see, that's the thing. Talk about movies that are quotable. Every line in that movie is quotable. That's, people are walking around for months afterward just quoting it, every scene. You realize that was his gift was the dialogue.
Sure.
As crazy as all the cinematography was, the really great thing was how well he wrote.
That's it, yeah.
And scenes where people are just sitting around talking. That's the thing. The most memorable scenes are people just sitting around talking. You're in a diner or a car, or you're that's where the best stuff was. It's like the screenplay was the star of that movie.
I got what do you got next, John?
Yeah, that should have been on my list. Yeah, that's a big one. That was a big one in the 90s. That was just the movie. What are we down to? The last three. Ah, this is going to be rough. Well, any list of movies that have knocked me out, it's going to have to include Paper Moon. So that's got to be in there. And I'm trying to think the first time I saw that was probably on TV. It would have to have
you
been.
You introduced me to that movie. So that is I just rewatched it. It's great.
I think I stumbled upon it like just late night TV. Somebody was running it on late night TV. It just blew me away just because... it's just so beautifully shot. I mean, it's got a lot of humor and pathos, but it's just an interesting time period. That's the thing. I like period movies. And when you say one is good, it's always like, well, how do you know? When they nail it, it's like people say, well, how do you know? You weren't alive in the 30s, but you can tell when they get it wrong.
Sure.
A lot of, in the 70s, there were a lot of movies covering that time period, like the 30s and the 20s. That was kind of like,
and yeah.
And sometimes they nailed it and sometimes they don't. And I guess that's the thing. You know when they don't because they don't get the haircuts right or the clothes don't look right or it looks like a set or the cars aren't right. So when they nail it, it's just a gut feeling. Probably from seeing a lot of old 30s movies. You just kind of get it. And it's definitely Peter Bogdanovich is doing an homage to his favorite movies of the 30s. You know, John Ford pictures.
Sure.
And he interviewed John Ford and Orson Welles and Howard Hawks. He knew all those guys, picked their brains. And so I think he knew how to do this movie. And the black and white is gorgeous. The cinematography is just amazing. And he's going for that look. It's not just the time period as far as what was going on, but the time period as far as what the movies looked like in the 30s.
And he really knocks. I just watched it again. I told you I did a double feature of Grapes of Wrath and Paper Moon, and it was perfect.
What a great double feature.
It covers the same era.
Yeah. You got the real thing, and then you got somebody's take on it. Yeah.
And what really struck me about the Paper Moon watching it again was the score is perfect because he's not cherry picking like the hits that everybody knows.
Right.
It's stuff that would have been on the radio at the time.
It's off the beaten track.
Yeah.
They're not even national hits sometimes.
No. Yeah. And
also it's perfect because it always seems to be just sort of like on in the background. She's got her little radio. She always carries this little radio in her under her arm, and so anywhere they go, they're on the road the whole movie, she plugs in her radio, and there's always something just sort of creeping out of the radio.
Yeah.
It might be Jack Benny, or it might be Paul
Whiteman
or something like that, or but it's always sort of like in the background, you know, when they're at a hotel or they're staying in somebody's house. It's always just sort of, it's not overwhelming. It's not like in your lap, like, hey, it's 1935.
Yeah, exactly.
It sort of like makes sense. That's the other reason it feels real, is because it's not ladled on with a heavy hand. It kind of feels like, yeah, this, if you were going to hear this music, it would be just kind of like coming down the road something like that.
Yeah.
The performances are great. It's kind of gimmicky when you look at it now. You go, oh, it's Ryan O'Neal and his daughter playing, a man and his daughter. But it really works. The humor's great. And the main thing is it just shot so beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all these...
There's scenes in there that'll stay with you.
Yeah, and there's some really poignant scenes, some scenes that really, like, choke you up. Because it's handling some sort of, deep themes because... this is a little girl that's got no place to go. Her mom just died, and so this this guy comes along, and they say, "Can you take her to her relatives?" And it turns out this is probably her dad.
Maybe, yeah.
All through the movie, she's like, "We got the same jaw." And so, yeah, I'm not your dad.
Yeah.
Eat your Coney Island. So it's definitely worth seeing. It's just
and Ryan O'Neal's so good.
He really is.
He's so good in it.
And there's so many people in this movie that turn up like in Blazing Saddles. Madeline Kahn.
Sure.
Burton Gilliam.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I'm trying to think, there was a reason. I think the casting, there's a reason. I heard Mel Brooks and Peter Bogdanovich both talking about this. There's a reason why they were sharing casts. Because he was getting ready to do Blazing Saddles, I think, right after Paper Moon. And so, or vice versa. But they might have had the same casting director, same talent agency. There's a reason where you're going, oh, yeah, you're kind of seeing the same faces.
Yeah.
John Hillerman would turn
up
in some movies. So I don't know. It's just a slice of life. It's just this guy and his daughter traveling.
And you believe you're in the – if you didn't know – if it wasn't shot widescreen and you didn't know – if you had no idea those actors were – they weren't actors from the 30s, you would just assume, okay, this is a – I'm watching something from the...
They did a lot of... When you read about how they pulled it off to make it really feel like it's 35, there's a really great documentary that comes with the DVD. And so they shot it out in the middle of nowhere in the 70s. So you could still find towns that looked like they did during the Depression. So I think they're out in the middle of Kansas or something. And they shot in these little towns where there wasn't much work to do. They said they still had these old general stores and these old streets. And all they had to do was get the right cars, get the right clothes... They'd hire a lot of local people. They'd find some people that were like, because they wanted local accents and people that didn't seem like actors. So there's some scenes where they go into a general store or a gas station, and it's a real guy from the area with the real accent, and it just works.
Yeah.
And he said in some cases, all they had to do is they'd say to the city, if you let us cut down they'll be on a street and say, this looks like 1935, but they've all got modern parking meters. So he said, if you let us cut down all the parking meters, we'll put them right back up after the movie. And it's back in the days, I guess, where you could do that, you know?
Wow.
He said, we'll cut them down, and when the movie's done, we'll put them right back in again. We'll install them again, but we have to get rid of these modern parking meters. So you have these scenes where, it's the middle of the Depression, and
sure.
it's Dust Bowl-type situation. You got, like, a tumbleweed blowing through town, and you got all these Model Ts parked on the street, and it just looks like the real deal.
The dog crossing the street. I always say that's my
favorite.
But
he's a con man, and so the whole thing is just funny because she ends up being smarter than Ryan O'Neal. I mean, she's like 9 years old, and she's smarter than he is. He's supposed to be the con man, and so most of the comedy comes from how much smarter she is, much more worldly than he is.
If you've never seen it,
yeah,
do yourself a favor and check it out. It's a really great...
It is. It's a gem. It's something you have to almost stumble upon. I just caught it on late night TV, and from then on, when it came out on video, I snapped it up. When it was on DVD, I snapped it up. And when it hit its 50th anniversary, they did a big deal out at the Egyptian. They struck a new print. Peter Bogdanovich.
40th.
Yeah.
40th anniversary.
Peter, did you go with me?
No.
Peter Bogdanovich was there, and the cinematographer had just passed away. So they did this big, here it is. Nobody's seen this. This is a brand new print. This is as beautiful as it's ever going to look.
Oh, that had to be great.
But it's definitely worth catching. Paper Moon is definitely worth catching. One of my all-time favorites.
On the opposite scale of gorgeous cinematography, but black and white, Night of the Living Dead. this is a movie that this kind of kicked off my love of zombies, and it felt real to me because the house that they're holed up in kind of reminded me of my grandma's ranch house where we grew up, and
so it must have felt
it felt like something that could happen. And you know, we've talked about this before, John, the way it's shot. My brother has a great story of stumbling upon this on like KDOC and like in like the early 70s and just being freaked out while at my grandma's house, like late one night by himself. And
in that house. Oh,
and
my
just,
God.
He's just thinking, well, this is it. This is how I die. But that is one of the all-time great horror movies.
It looks like a documentary.
Yeah.
I think that's why it's so freaky. It looks like somebody just grabbed the camera and shot it while it was happening.
Yeah.
There's no production values.
Yeah.
So you go, oh, this could be it. This could happen.
Yeah, that's it. You've seen it. We've all seen it. I don't want to go into too great a detail because we're almost out of time.
I think I ate into your time.
No, it's fine.
I'll tell you the problem is, if somebody says Paper Moon, I could talk for 2 hours.
Give me, let's see, you're at 1, 2, 3... 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. How many do we have left? 9 and 10?
Yeah.
Okay, give me number 9.
Oh, God. I'm looking at how many of these movies are in black and white.
That's okay.
I'm missing a whole chunk. This is like movies that meant something special to you kind of hit you.
Sure.
So that cuts out a lot of just good movies that didn't particularly strike a chord.
Mm-hmm. Honorable mention, Born on the 4th of July. Not a good movie, but it was the first movie my wife and I ever saw on a date.
Oh, wow.
Because I'm a romantic.
Wow, is that right?
Yep. Eat your heart out, ladies. So honorable mention to that.
Did that end up being a good date movie?
No, not at all. It's okay. I just liked, I thought, well, Tom Cruise is in it.
That's interesting.
And, you know, who doesn't want to see Tom Cruise?
That's a sad
paying
movie.
Pairing a paraplegic.
That's a sad movie to see on your first date.
Yeah. I made it up to where I took her to McDonald's beforehand, so.
What was your second movie?
None of this is, I don't remember.
You don't remember?
I don't remember. Pulp Fiction? Wouldn't it be awesome? It's like, hey, look, I'm sorry about last time. Let's go watch this movie with a gimp.
We're going to see this movie called Clockwork Orange.
Yeah. That's my honorable mention. But what do you got? What's next?
God, it's rough. And there's nothing current. This is all just stuff that knocked me out when I was like, you know, a kid or high school. Well, I guess I'd have to put I got to put Buster Keaton in there, the General.
Oh, awesome.
Because I really didn't know anything about Buster Keaton. I always thought, you know, when they talked about silent comedies, I thought, well, you got Chaplin and you got Laurel and Hardy and what else is there? And I don't think I'd seen any Buster Keaton. But back in like, I think it was the 80s, somebody had struck new prints of all his features. Some guy was painstakingly, I forget his name, but he was buying up every print because I think a lot of them were in the public domain. And he was trying to find the best possible prints and then striking new copies. And at the New Art out in Santa Monica, sometimes they do a whole week of just one artist, you know, Preston Sturges or Chaplin or something. And they said, this week it's going to be all Buster Keaton. Monday through Friday, every night we're going to do a couple features. And they played all of his features, and they were all new prints. And I hadn't seen anything, so I just thought, oh, I'm going to check this out. I did something I could never do again. I took the whole week off. I just thought, I got to see these. They say he's the best thing since Chaplin. I got to see these. So I took the week off, and I went every night.
Wow. Now, you and I ended up, you introduced me to Keaton when my leg was broken. You brought over 3 tapes.
Yeah.
And you had taped, they ran all of his silent stuff on KCET on PBS.
Yeah.
And you recorded with a documentary.
Yes.
And you said to me.
Yes, a hard act to follow, a three-part British documentary.
You said to me, you have nothing to do, watch these. And I was hooked. From the first one, I was hooked. And yeah, I have to thank you for that.
I got to hand it to you because you returned the favor. You made me a highlight reel of all the best Jackie Chan stunts.
Yes, that's right.
So I wouldn't have to sit through every Jackie Chan movie because you realized the best stuff is the stunts.
Yes, so or you, the comedy bits. Sorry.
You painstakingly put together a clip reel of all his best
stuff.
That
was back in the VHS days.
And I remember watching and going, this is great because there's a connection between Keaton and Chaplin. Mm-hmm. And I should say between Jackie Chan and Keaton.
Definitely.
And when we saw Jackie Chan, he said his favorite guys were Buster Keaton and Gene Kelly.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
But yeah, so I mean, that was the out of all of those movies, The General was the mind blower because talk about trying to get the period right. You know, he got a train that was, he didn't want to do it unless he could get a train that was exactly right. It's supposed to be during the Civil War. He found a train. He found some track, I think, in Oregon that still ran on that gauge track.
And Cottage Grove.
Yeah.
Shout out to Chris Graham.
And it was like side by side, two tracks side by side, so he could shoot the train while it was running on the other track. It's insane. It probably took like a year to shoot.
Yeah, it's amazing, though. If you've never seen it, watch it.
And people that are in the Civil War say this probably looks more real than any Civil War movie that's a drama because he just got it right. Yeah. And because he's such a deadpan presence, they look like Matthew Brady photos. His his face looks like a Matthew Brady photo already because he doesn't smile.
Yeah.
So it's a great one because he's doing all his own stunts and there's just a lot there. And it's all on the train. It's like, you know, there's the scene where they burn down the bridge and the train goes into the river. They really did that.
Yeah.
It's like you could only get that in one take.
Apparently the wreckage stayed there for years.
I think it's still under the water.
Apparently the wreckage stayed there. According to Chris.
If you're going to see one silent movie, I would say that's the one. You run into people going, oh, I don't like silent movies. If you're going to give it a chance, give one silent movie a chance, this is the one.
Just remember.
That could pull you in. Because it's so well done, so beautiful, so funny. If there's any chance, you know, that it'll turn you into a Buster Keaton fan.
Yeah, more people are familiar with Chaplin by far. But,
and Chaplin's great, but I remember thinking, I need to see this other guy, because people kept saying, if there's a guy who's as good as Chaplin or better, it's Keaton.
I would say he's better. His movies have a very modern feel.
That's the thing. Keaton, with Chaplin, you're looking at something that feels dated. It's amazing what he does with his face and his body, but they always feel a little dated. And when you see a Keaton movie, you go, God, that could have been last week because of his attitude. He's got a modern attitude, which is, don't cry for me. It just is what it is. We're stuck in the gears. You know?
Yeah, that's it.
Ironically, you know, it's just like you just have to take it with a straight face.
All right. I'm not to rush you, John, but I got my number nine. That was your number nine, right?
That was my number nine.
Number nine. I'm going to say Raiders of the Lost Ark because it informed my taste. It made the 30s accessible to me.
So it
made me want to like. So anytime it gave me a feel for movies like Gunga Din and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that really opened a whole other door for me.
Sure. Yeah. Wow.
And then also it was the only movie I ever saw with my entire family.
Oh.
So brothers, mom, dad, we all went to see it.
Wow.
And my dad and my uncle loved it. Like that was the guy that this was the action hero that they had been waiting for, you know. And again, you know, like Star Wars, it reminded my dad of the serials when he was a kid.
Yeah.
So I loved it. Yeah. So Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
That's okay.
What a great one.
Yeah.
What a great one.
Yeah. What's your last one, John? Pick. I know it's hard. I finally settled on my last one.
Yeah.
And it's pretty modern. Yeah, Raiders, man. Good stuff. Watch it. I think it's on Amazon.
Well, this is a weird one. We're not going in any particular order, I guess. You could probably see this one coming. The Empire Strikes Back.
Hey, there you go.
Because I loved Star Wars. It was the greatest. It blew my mind. I saw it a million times. But then 3 years later, seeing The Empire Strikes Back, it was just more of it. Everything you loved about Star Wars, you got in spades. You got extra doses. You know, as far as everything, the humor, the chases, the effects, everything. You just got more of it. This is why I like The Empire Strikes Back better than Star Wars.
Yeah.
If you love Star Wars, you're going to get that and even more with The Empire Strikes Back. So that's
when, one of the all-time great movie moments. I remember when the big reveal happened, I looked up at my godfather and said, did he just say what I think he said? Yeah. I mean, you were already older, John. Well, you're older than me, so you were, what, maybe in your teens when Empire came out?
I was out of high school.
And what was the? I mean, what was it like to just?
I hate to say it, but somebody spoiled it for me.
No.
I saw it the week it came out. Don't know if it was like the second or third day. It wasn't the first day. And some bonehead at work. I can't remember who, but somebody kind of like walked through and, oh yeah, can you believe it? And it's like, oh, really? And I've heard other people tell stories like that. Like somebody, like they're in line and somebody walks past and goes, ah, guess who dies, you know? And somebody had spoiled it for me. It was still a mind blower, but you know, it's one of those things. You'll never know how you would have responded if you hadn't seen it till you sat down. God.
It.
Tell a story about your daughter. I tell this story all the time about when you showed Empire Strikes Back, what her response was to that line.
She really was not. She was leaning into the TV, and I remember she reared back. I remember she reared back, and she looked at me. Didn't say anything, but just looked at me, and I was like, yeah, I know, kid. like.
But she did what she said, is that true? And
yeah.
You said you'll just have to wait and find out.
When the movie was over, she goes, is it true? And I said, well, you got to wait and see. And
That's such a great answer.
Yeah.
Instead of just saying, well, you'll have to check.
But I remember she was leaning into it, and then she just kind of leaned back when he said that, and she's like, what? And then she looked up at me, and I looked at her, and I just looked back at the TV, and then when it goes quiet again, when the whole scene's over, she said, is it true? Is that true? And I said, you have to wait and see. Yeah.
When I showed it to my nephew, he was like 5, and when they were waiting for me to come visit, so they ran the first 2 movies. And the second one, I'm kind of like, out of the corner of my eye, I'm looking to see what he's going to say, because he's about 5 when we're running this. And when he says, I am your father, he waits a beat and he goes, he's not his father. And I thought, that was an interesting response.
Yeah, right.
He just doesn't believe it. Yeah. He really doesn't believe it.
Bullsh.
He's just saying that.
Yeah, man, that's it. Love it.
And my nephew's name is Luke. So I get to, when we're playing Star Wars, I get to say that, you know.
I love it.
Luke.
My last one is going to be a very recent movie. It's going to be Coco from Pixar.
Oh, wow.
Not only was it it was emotional. I cried and my wife cried. My daughter sobbed. But it's just nice to be represented and in a very accurate they were very careful. You could tell Pixar was very careful. It felt very, it didn't feel like they were... what's the word I'm looking for? Pandering. It didn't feel like they were pandering.
Yeah.
It was
legit.
It was a legit, you know, and they did, you know, they avoided a lot of cheap laughs and it was real respectful of the culture. And I know people that know nothing about the culture who said, you know, after seeing that, now I know what I thought Dia de los Muertos was it like Mexican Halloween. And I understand what that means now. And I understand that it's, you know, it's about honoring family. And so, you know, if you can pull that off, I mean, that's amazing. So, and it really just, it was good. It was good to not be the drug dealer or be, you know, or be the bad guy or, you know.
The bandit.
The bandit. And, or, you know, the comic relief. Although technically there was. But, and there were so many nods to the culture that it just felt, It was a movie I walked out feeling, and when you see a movie like that and your kids you says, wow, this makes me proud to be who I am.
Wow.
That's something that's, you know. So
yeah.
That for me is that's the movie in the most recent memory that just I'll always carry that with me.
Yeah.
You know.
It meant something.
It meant something.
That's
what
film can do.
Mm-hmm.
You know. It's not just a way to kill 2 hours. It could really be something.
Yeah, it's not King Kong versus Godzilla, but...
it can be something very important in your life.
Well,
if you catch a good one that has something to say.
Sure.
Yeah.
Hey, we're all a little soul, big part of the big soul.
Mm.
Just like the preacher says. Mm. Right, Ma? That's right. Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah. Did that make your list?
It didn't, but God.
I know. Now I'll be walking out the door going, oh, Sullivan's Travels.
I could do a list of 100 movies that
I know.
Have meant something to me.
It's good that you made it 10, because obviously I go on too long with one. I could do a whole goddamn show about Strangelove.
Yeah. We do a week of them.
Yeah.
So John and I will be back. Actually, we're going to do... We'll be back very soon. But, John.
God, we killed 2 hours. You were supposed to do some questions from the...
We'll throw them on as a bonus for them. Okay. We'll stick around.
You know what? You should have cut me off.
Yeah.
When I was going on too long about...
John, this is what the podcast is about.
The general. You should have said, okay, they don't need to know what you ate the night you saw the general. They don't need to know which seat you... They don't need to know what brand candy bar you're eating the night you saw the general.
Okay. For John said, this is great. I'm going to play a little... This is from... Michael Giacchino's score for Coco. And this is called Crossing the Marigold Bridge. I love this piece of music. And so this is what we're going to say goodbye with. And John and I will see you next time. So until then, fight the power. And this transmission ends now. Keep watching those movies.